It is only right and fair that people have access to the health care they need, and that they have access to health care in an environment where they are treated with dignity and respect. And please do understand that when we talk about a clinic such as this, it is absolutely about health care and reproductive health care.
Vice President Kamala Harris last week in an abortion clinic in Minnesota. She made history as the first sitting vice president to visit a facility that offers abortion care. Over a million abortions were performed last year in the U.S., the highest number seen in over a decade, according to new research released by the Guttmacher Institute. Despite total bans in 14 states, the data show a rise in abortions nationwide. Alice Miranda Olstein joins me now. She covers healthcare policy on Capitol Hill for Politico. Welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be back.
So what do we know about why this increase is happening? Does it have anything to do with telehealth and medication abortion?
That's definitely a big factor. So, you know, it may seem counterintuitive that the total number of abortions have gone up despite all of these state bans. But I think, you know, there are a lot of things fueling it. One, there's just way more avenues for people to obtain abortion pills than there were even a few years ago. So just recently, big retail pharmacies like CVS and Walgreens started selling them. Smaller pharmacies had already been doing that for a bit. There are these telemedicine provisions. A lot of blue states passed these so-called shield laws so that doctors in blue states can prescribe abortion pills to patients in red states without being afraid of getting sued. And overseas groups like Aid Access have mobilized to mail people abortion pills as well. And you've seen the number of abortions also go up in blue states. I'm thinking of California specifically. You know, it's a big state. There's a lot of rural areas. Access to abortion was not great in a lot of places, even when Roe versus Wade was still in place. But this new environment we're in has really galvanized Democratic officials to do more to expand access, even within blue states. And so a lot of different factors in why we're seeing those numbers go up.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was curious if that was part of it, that there's just so much more attention, resources being given to this issue. I'm also curious, though, like, what do we know in general over time? Because this report points out that abortions actually peaked in 1990 and then came down. Why do we think that they began to decline over that? Is that about access or better reproductive care sort of throughout the system?
You know, better sexual education and better contraceptive access. And then, you know, more recently, contraceptive access was expanded a lot under the Affordable Care Act. You know, birth control was free to people with insurance for the first time. And so that really expanded access as well. But now, you know, you're seeing those numbers tick back up again, which is a really interesting trend.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, for abortion, pro-abortion folks, this is good news that there's still access being offered despite some of these bans. But I'm wondering what we know about who was not able to access care, especially given, you know, some of the inequities we know in the healthcare system more broadly.
There are a lot of people who are not able to travel out of state or figure out how to order abortion pills online. You know, the most impacted folks are the most impacted folks for other health disparities as well. You know, poor people, people of color, people with disabilities, people who are undocumented immigrants who may be afraid of traveling across state lines, people who are on parole who can't travel across state lines. You know, there's just a lot of different already marginalized groups that are really hit hard on this. And, you know, we've seen these stories come out of people who wanted abortions and were not able to have them and either found themselves in a medical crisis. We've seen that come up in lawsuits in Texas and Oklahoma and Idaho and other red states. And we've also, you know, seen very moving stories of people who did give birth and are now really struggling financially to raise those children.
Yeah. I wonder, like, this was put out by the Guttmacher Institute. They are in support of abortion access. But do you ever talk to activists who worry that these sorts of numbers could actually galvanize opponents of abortion from a political perspective?
Sure. I mean, it kind of cuts both ways because there have also been reports put out on, you know, how much abortions have plummeted in states with bans, and anti-abortion groups have held up those numbers. Some of those numbers and data also come from, you know, pro-abortion rights sources like Guttmacher and other groups. And so the data can provide kind of a Rorschach test. And so it you can see what you want in it. And so I have seen anti-abortion groups point to, oh, you know, this many tens of thousands of you know, abortions didn't happen because of Dobbs in X state, and celebrating that, whereas others are celebrating the expansion of access that was in this new report.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you follow this also closely. I know there's a pending case at the Supreme Court over medication abortion access. We've seen Democrats just broadly use this as a winning issue at the ballot box. And then you recently wrote about former Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway urging Republicans to, quote, flip the script on this and really talk about policies that she sees as a compromise, like a 15-week ban, which I know is being called a minimum standard in her party. I mean, heading into this November, is there a path for the GOP to use this as a potent political tool, or does it seem like Democrats kind of have the wind at their back?
So, I mean, the polling shows that more people are with Democrats on this issue than are with Republicans. Republicans have also sort of continued to struggle to have a coherent message on abortion since the fall of Roe. I mean, Roe was very unifying for them. It was really easy for them to say for decades, you know, I'm against Roe versus Wade. I want it overturned. Now that that's happened, there's a lot tougher questions. You know, how many weeks would you allow? What kinds of exemptions would you allow? You know, it just gets really hard. And of course, we just had the whole blow up over the implications for IVF, which sort of caught a lot of people of all parties, you know, really off guard. And there's been a big scramble to respond to that. There's also a divide among Republicans about whether Congress or a president even should have a role here, or if it should be completely left up to the states. That split is something we've been continuing to track. And so there just really isn't sort of a coherent plan or message. Republicans have been trying a lot of different things. You know, after the midterms in 2022 were disappointing for Republicans, a lot of anti-abortion groups came out and said, well, you lost because you didn't campaign hard enough on opposing abortion and wanting to restrict it. But we've also seen candidates who have run on opposing abortion and wanting to restrict it lose as well. And so it's been a very rocky couple of years for them.
All right. Well, I know you'll keep an eye on this. As we said, the Biden administration, at least trying to embrace this as an issue with Harris visiting that clinic last week. Alice Miranda Olstein is a healthcare reporter for Politico. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, inflation has leveled off in most sectors, but home prices continue to rise. We'll explain a new legal settlement that's poised to slash realtor fees and dig into President Biden's plan to make housing more affordable. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos in for Madeline Brand. It could soon be a lot easier and cheaper to sell your home. For decades, sellers have paid an industry standard 6% of the sale price to agents, which can amount to tens of thousands of dollars. Well, now the National Association of Realtors has to change its rules on commissions as part of a settlement of a class action lawsuit. Many realtors are outraged, but some housing experts say the change could spark a recovery in the housing market. Joining me now is Deborah Kamen. She covers real estate for the New York Times. Welcome to Press Play, Deborah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. I am really eager to get in and understand a little more about this settlement that was approved last week. So the National Association of Realtors has agreed to pay $418 million. But the real big news is that they're changing the structure of commissions. Can you just walk us through like how we got here and what exactly the group was accused of?
Yeah, so the $418 million, it's sticker shock. It's a big number, but that is not the story here. The story here is that they're changing their rules, exactly like you said. The National Association of Realtors for the past several years has faced a number of lawsuits that have accused it of a conspiracy to price fix commissions. That's the 3% that we pay our seller's agents and 3% we pay our buyer's agents when we sell or buy a home. And essentially, because of their rules, there was no competition in the market. And that 6%, even though it wasn't written in stone, became the industry standard.
So tell us what that means for buyers and sellers. Like in LA, the average price of a home hovers around $1 million. What would the commission look like on a $1 million home sale?
I love a math question with easy numbers. Thank you. So for a $1 million home, I can do that math in my head. The commission would be $60,000. So essentially, if I'm selling a home that's worth $1 million, I have to pay, or I had to pay before the settlement, about $60,000 to my real estate agents. $30,000 of that would go to the seller agent, my agent, and then that agent would then pay $30,000 to the buyer agent. And that's the crux of the issue. The seller's agents were splitting commission with the buyer's agents in a way that eliminated competition from the market.
So, how much lower will commissions be now?
Economists who are talking about this estimate that commissions are going to drop probably about 2 percentage points. To put it into real numbers, Americans have been paying about $100 billion a year, that's with a B, to real estate agents and commissions. And they probably estimate that that's going to go down between $20 and $50 billion after commissions really come down because of competition.
All right. Well, that's not probably great news for real estate agents, which we'll get to. But I'm curious,
Yes.
like, what this changes for buyers, right? So if I buy a home now, the person I'm buying it for is paying these fees. Would I now have to pay out of my pocket if the seller isn't required to cover that entire commission?
So that is the rub in the settlement. Yes, the buyer's fee used to be paid by the seller. And now, if the rules of this are followed, it will be passed on to the buyer. However, home prices across the board are probably going to come down because that 6% was essentially baked into the house, the home price before. Like if I'm selling a home and I'm sitting with my agent and we're pricing the house, they're going to tell me, let's bump up that price about 6% to cover the cost of the fee. So even though buyers are now probably going to have to pay a fee to their agent, the home they're buying is probably going to be a bit cheaper. And also, buyers may choose not to use an agent. Before, you had to use one, but now with people shopping on places like Zillow and Redfin, doing so much of the work themselves, there's a whole market for the entire way we buy homes in America to shift.
Interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit about the National Association of Realtors who had to enter in the settlement. It's the largest professional organization in the country with more than 1 million members, and they're really politically powerful, right?
They are the largest trade organization in America, and they are also the largest political action committee in America. They have a lobbying arm that gives more money than anybody else to candidates. So they have a huge muscle in Washington, which is one of the reasons it's taken so long to really break this monopoly.
And but this was a suit filed by individual buyers too, not the government, right? Sort of
Correct.
underscoring
No, you
that.
are absolutely right. This was a civil suit filed by five home sellers in Missouri. The government has been investigating the National Association of Realtors for more than 20 years. There's an investigation going on right now with the Justice Department. This was not it. This was five normal people who sold their homes and found out after that they'd paid more than they needed to, and they didn't realize they could have negotiated the fee.
So okay, I mean, good news for buyers and sellers, not great for the association. But what about these individual agents? I mean, they're, real people too, and
Oh,
this is,
absolutely.
this is their what they've built their livelihood around. Like, how are they feeling? Do you think it might cause people to leave the industry?
You make an excellent point, and that's a piece of the story that really needs to be told. Realtors for a very long time have been very loyal to the National Association of Realtors, and many of them feel that they were let down here. They pay a huge amount of money in fees. They expected them to be represented in this law case, and NAR lost. And then they said they were going to appeal for months, and they didn't. They went ahead and settled. And the settlement came for many people as a surprise. So real estate agents today are really feeling like their ability to make an income has just been slashed and compromised, and they feel like they're being vilified. People saying that they're being paid too much, and they really are kind of left without any guidance. I think a lot of agents are going to leave the association in the months to come, and the entire industry is in for a huge shift.
So what does that mean? I mean, obviously we talked about the political potency of the National Association of Realtors, and already not everybody who sells homes is a member of the NAR, right? So could this sort of undercut their, political power? Could it caused that association to really change its structure?
Absolutely. So yes, not every single person who sells a home in America is a member of NAR. However, about 90% of home sale transactions are done by people who are members of NAR. There's a lot of people who just have a real estate license. They may have sold their cousin's house or, you know, gone to school for a couple of weeks and gotten the license, and maybe they sell one house a year. But the vast majority of agents in America are members of the association because so many of the rules have made it that if you want to sell a home and have access to the market, you have to belong. Mm. Those members are a huge piece of their political power because a lot of them donate and are really active. So as that membership dips, the political arm is also going to get weaker. And that's going to have an impact long term on the housing market in ways the settlement we don't even know yet.
Yeah. I mean, I got to go back to the consumer angle, though, because as a person who has lived in California my whole life, it just feels like almost false hope to think that prices would go down based on anything here. But I know, like, there's other aspects of this, like the way houses are listed, these multiple listing services, MLS, will change, too. So, I mean, when do you expect this to make a difference for consumers? And how should we think about, you know, if you're going back into the market, how different it's going to look maybe a year from now?
So there's going to be a couple aspects of the rollout to how this is going to have impact. First of all, I have to say this settlement still needs to be approved by the court. This is brand new. The ink on it is barely dry. They signed it at like 2 a.m. on Friday morning. It has to be approved by the court. Once it's approved by the court, it goes into effect in July. And then economists forecast that we'll start seeing changes in terms of commission structure in the months that follow. At the same time, it's also a class action lawsuit. So if you sold a house in the past 4 years and you paid a 6% commission, you might be getting a letter that says you actually are able to recoup a small part of that commission. So those are all pieces. In terms of the long-term impact, it could be years, it could be decades. What is important to understand is that this has been the structure of the U.S. housing market for a century. And this is a major change. And there have only been a couple moments in history of the U.S. housing market that have had changes like this. So we're going to see a long-term impact with several stages over the course of several years.
Well, Deborah, we will count on you to keep an eye on that and let us know how those all play out. Deborah Kamen is a reporter on the Realty Desk of the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Over the last 10 years, the average price of a house in America has gone up almost 50%. That's led to a crisis of affordable housing, especially in states like California. President Biden, stuck in a tough re-election fight against Donald Trump, is proposing some new policies to make housing more affordable. Here he is in the State of the Union a few weeks ago talking about one of those.
I want to provide an annual tax credit that will give Americans $400 a month for the next 2 years as mortgage rates come down, to put toward their mortgages when they buy their first home or trade up for a little more space.
We're going to talk about Biden's housing measures and what their prospects are in Congress with Adam Kinkren, who covers health, the economy, and other domestic issues for Politico. Hey, Adam.
Hey, Marisa. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for being here. So the president is in Nevada today, and you might recall, as I do, that the housing market there was hit very hard during his vice presidency by another big issue, the fallout from the financial crisis of 2008. People were defaulting on mortgages, empty homes. So does this tie back to that? Why Nevada now? Why housing in that state?
Yeah, absolutely. This is absolutely strategic on the side of the White House and the president. I mean, Nevada has a long history, as you just mentioned, of, you know, being very sensitive to swings in the housing market. Back then, we solved those foreclosures, we solved those issues, and now it's more of, you know, home prices soaring, housing supply just being super limited. We've seen a drop in the amount of available homes over the last 4 years. We've seen a jump in by about 20% of home prices over the last 4 years, and so you're really seeing the crunch that folks are feeling all across the country be really, really kind of defined here in Nevada and places like Las Vegas, especially where the president will be today.
Yeah. It's interesting because as a Californian, we think of Nevada as cheaper real estate, but there is not
Not
enough
so
of
much.
there's not enough of housing anywhere. I mean, you wrote in Politico that the Biden administration is really trying to counter sluggish consumer sentiment in general in this election year, and that they feel that it ties into how voters feel about the president himself. So what is Biden trying to do here when it comes sort of from a political standpoint?
Yeah, overarching, if you think about just the way that Biden has talked about the economy over the last year and a half, it's all been about combating inflation, lowering costs, really trying to take on all of the individual everyday cost drivers that Americans face. So you have things like healthcare, you have things like gas and groceries. And in most of those categories, the administration has been able to make significant progress from where we were, you know, in summer of 2022. And housing prices remain kind of the last major inflation driver. It accounted for about two-thirds of all inflation annually in February. So that's the main driver of costs now. And his aides have kind of become increasingly worried that it's become the main driver of people's negative perceptions about the overall economy and by extension, Biden himself. So what you're seeing here is this kind of renewed push to show people, you know, look, the White House is aware housing is a problem for renters and homeowners, and they're developing this plan to go after it and to attack that, even if maybe it's not possible in the next 6 months,
right,
then certainly over a second term.
All right. Well, we'll get into the politics in a second, but I do want to just have you spell out a few of these proposals. You know, the one we heard the president talk about is the mortgage relief credit. This would give Americans in the market for a first or second home a mortgage tax credit. Why this approach? Why are they highlighting that?
Yeah, there are a couple things you can try to do here. One is to boost new construction, the supply of houses. That obviously takes several years. It's a structural problem, really hard to fix in a few months. The other thing you can do is just make things more affordable, make it easier, subsidize people's purchases. And that's what a lot of these tax credits would do. They would make it, you know, more affordable for people to afford their first home. They would make it more affordable for people to sell their existing home and then buy a next home, obviously at higher mortgage rates. It would help to kind of neutralize that a little bit. So what you're seeing the administration try to do here is say, you know, look, here are some ideas that can immediately loosen up the supply a little bit, can immediately make it a little bit easier to afford a home or rent an apartment.
Yeah. I mean, on the other side, he's proposing incentivizing building. We're talking about $20 billion in grants for state, local and tribal jurisdictions to build. I mean, that feels like more honestly of a conservative approach, right? Letting the market sort of do this. Would that be enough to get any support from congressional Republicans, for example?
From congressional Republicans, most likely not. So we've asked a few. And unsurprisingly, maybe the attitude is when it comes to any doing anything big legislatively, especially in election year, there's not really any appetite on the Republican side to do anything that could help Biden or his reelection effort. But one of the things that the White House has stressed is where you do see some, you know, conservative or Republican buy-in is on the local and state level, where, you know, these kinds of land use issues, you know, zoning and things like that, have become real barriers to new construction in municipalities. And so that's kind of what that innovation fund would go after. And that's gotten folks more on the local level really excited.
Yeah, I'm wondering like how you see this changing. I mean, I think for a long time, we haven't had a lot of state or really federal sort of role like playing in this other than, you know, the sort of bank bailout. And in California, political debates over housing have really shifted. I think you have those on the left embracing things like, you know, these incentives, this idea that market rate construction could bring down prices overall. Have those politics shifted nationally or in other states that you're seeing at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're seeing any kind of a, I don't know, major shift politically, it's from housing kind of being dismissed as, you know, a local municipal issue of, oh, there are regional problems here, but that doesn't reflect the broader country. Things are so diverse that it's almost impossible to run a campaign nationally, as an example, on a political issue of housing, just that it doesn't really scale. And I think you're seeing a real shift in the conventional wisdom there, because now we're looking nationwide and saying, look, the housing issues aren't just in California or Nevada or New York. It's nationwide. Everywhere people are having trouble affording this really basic and necessary expense. And you may not be seeing that come up in polling when, you know, you ask people, what's your top issue, right? But Biden aides are pretty confident that it is being kind of subsumed into this broader concern about the economy overall. And so now you're seeing it reflected on a national scale.
All right. So as you said, you know, this is really an attempt by Biden to lay out a vision. It doesn't appear like it'll get through this Congress. But, you know, Biden said at the top that as mortgage rates come down, but that's a bit of an uncertainty, right? I mean, inflation has come down, but as you pointed out, housing prices are still going up. And we don't know if the Fed is going to lower interest rates yet. Is that something you think he's kind of banking on?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the biggest frustration for the White House and also, you know, progressive Democrats especially, is that the only thing you can really do to bring down mortgage rates directly is for the Federal Reserve to cut rates. And unfortunately, you know, for the administration, they have no control over that and have been really cautious about not putting political pressure on the Fed in the same way that Donald Trump did 4 years ago. So what I think you're trying to see, what you're seeing, you know, Biden and Democrats do instead is try to figure out, are there smaller things they can do? We've seen a lot of focus on so-called junk fees in the housing arena. That means, you know, trying to do things that lower closing costs, trying to crack down on price gouging in the rental market. These more kind of enforcement regulatory areas that the government does have control over and can say, look, we made a little bit of progress here, even as we're waiting for the big cost drivers like mortgage rates to come down.
All right. We're going to leave it there. Adam Cankren covers health, the economy, and other domestic issues for Politico. Thanks so much, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on Press Play, Julio Torres joins us to talk about his new feature film, Problemista. It's a whimsical and sometimes surreal take on the challenges of navigating the U.S. immigration system. Coming up, from being bullied at home to attending one of the world's most elite ballet schools, the story of a Nigerian boy whose dancing captured the world's attention.
You know, kids in Nigeria, they're either going to work for the family to help put food on the table, they're going to school, they're playing sports, not ballet.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos, in for Madeline Brandt. It's Tuesday, and that means it's time for TV on the Radio.
Dancing is kind of like a way of telling a story about how you feel.
Sometimes I express joy. Sometimes I express pain.
It's kind of like letting go of the anger in me and, like, sadness in me.
11-year-old Anthony Amadou's life changed forever in 2020. A 44-second video of him ballet dancing barefoot in the rain in his native Nigeria went viral after actress Viola Davis tweeted it. Millions of people saw him leaping, twirling, and gliding over the glistening concrete. And it made him an internet star and captured the attention of an elite conservatory in the UK.
We wanted to talk to you about Anthony, your son. We saw him on Instagram and on the news. He had so much raw talent that we are interested in at the school.
You must be very proud.
I'm very proud of him.
Anthony is the subject of a new documentary called Madu. It's directed by Matt Ogans, who's with me now. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, we're so glad you're here. I would love to start, for those who missed this viral moment, remind us how and why it became such a big deal.
I think people were really struck by the juxtaposition of this kid doing ballet against the backdrop of where he comes from. And I imagine that's when it went viral. What's interesting is we found the video about a week before it went viral. There was maybe only a few hundred hits. My producer, Jamie Patrickoff, who I've worked with on and off for years, just texted me the video with no context. And in fact, the first time I saw it, it didn't have a name. It didn't say Nigeria. It didn't have a lot of context. I was personally struck by his confidence. It was like as if he didn't have a care in the world. Mm. And I was so curious. And that's how I always start with a story, is with my curiosity. I just wanted to know his story, and went down the internet rabbit hole and found him. And within a week was Zooming with him and his family from here in Los Angeles to the outskirts of Lagos, Nigeria. And that's how we connected and how it started.
That's incredible. I was wondering kind of, because you're really there from the beginning for this. So you just sort of had this curiosity, which I really relate to. That's how I feel like I like to approach my interviews as well. So when you reached out, you didn't know that he would be going to this elite school.
Did not know. It did not go viral yet. Like it was days away, a week away, maybe. We didn't know. And so we had many conversations with him and his family and gain their trust. Then I felt like it would be really important to collaborate and bring on a local Nigerian filmmaker to co-direct with me. I had never co-directed anything. I've done a lot of stories of, you know, diverse characters and cultures around the world. But for this one, something in my gut felt like it would add value, and together we could make a great film if I made this with someone that understood where Anthony came from and his journey. And I went down another rabbit hole of looking at different filmmakers in Nigeria and saw a piece of work by a filmmaker named Kachi Benson and reached out to him, and together we made this film. And I think the combination of a visual style that I've developed coming off of my last film, Audible, a couple years ago, to my experience in storytelling and his experience relating to Anthony, we really made what we think is a beautiful film together. I think we all had confidence that he was going to have an amazing journey. And even if he never left Nigeria, and we just got lucky, but more importantly, he just got lucky to have this opportunity to be called by Elmhurst Ballet School.
I want to talk about Elmhurst Ballet School, because it's a very elite school, almost impossible to get into. I mean, what did the school say about inviting him into the program?
It wasn't just jumping on the bandwagon of the viral video. They spoke to him, they got to know him, they got to know his family, and they saw his passion. And then hopefully you see it in the film, but we saw it as, you know, you see Anthony and he can't stop dancing even when he's not on camera or in a ballet class. He just lives it and breathes it. And there was something about his passion that we felt, and clearly the school felt as well, and felt that they help elevate him to the next level and be of value to him. And I'm sure him be of value to the school, and you know, his fellow students learn from him.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, before he journeys there, you know, you document some of his family life in Lagos, Nigeria. Can you just talk a little bit about his upbringing and life there, and how he stumbled into ballet?
Yeah, he lives in a neighborhood about 29 kilometers outside of Lagos city center. It's still in Lagos, but because of traffic and roads, it actually takes 2 to 3 hours to get there. And if you, as my co-director, Kachi Benson, would tell me, if you lined up 10 Nigerians in downtown Lagos and named his neighborhood, most of them would not have heard of it. He calls it almost like a forgotten neighborhood. Dirt roads, electricity often goes out at night. His mother runs a very small, I'd say, kiosk, almost like a home products, shampoos and soaps and, you know, different sundries. Dad has a motorbike where you can pay him almost like a taxi and jump on the back. And, you know, they don't make a lot of money, you know, $3, $4, $5, $6 a day, maybe. Not a lot of opportunity. And a boy in Nigeria doesn't do ballet. That's why you see he gets mocked. You know, he gets bullied. He, you know, kids in Nigeria, they're, either going to work for the family to help put food on the table. They're going to school. They're playing sports, not ballet. So he's, you know, even his brother and him are at odds at times because his brother doesn't quite understand it. You know, he just found it like a lot of kids find things, you know, online, YouTube, different things like that, cartoons, and, you know, little ballet schools, you know, in someone's backyard, but nothing formal. There's no like formal academy training. So he didn't have that foundation that a lot of the kids at Elmhurst had, who maybe started when they were 4 years old going to real ballet schools.
I'm Marisa Lagos in for Madeline Brand on 89.9 KCRW. Oscar-nominated director Matt Ogens is our guest. We're talking about the documentary Madu. It's about a little boy in Lagos, Nigeria, who went viral after ballet dancing barefoot in the rain, and how his life has drastically changed since. I mean, Matt, talk a little bit more about the bullying that Anthony faced, because he really seems to carry that trauma forward into his time in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, he handles it quite well. He's really resilient. I mean, you see at the beginning that, yes, it affects him being bullied, being mocked, not having many friends, but it doesn't stop him. You know, it's not enough. It's not strong enough against the power of his passion for expressing himself. He's going to do it anyway. And it could have, you know, knocked a lot of us off our socks and said, you know, maybe this isn't for me. But certainly, whether he's aware of it or not, he's a kid. I don't know that he was so conscious of it until he starts going on his journey. So he does carry that with him. The film ultimately, yes, it's through the lens of ballet, but it's really about acceptance and belonging. In Nigeria, clearly, he as you said, is not accepted, right? He doesn't belong. When he gets to England, he's found, in a way, quote unquote, his tribe. So all his peers are ballet, and he's in this new place where everyone understands ballet, but is he accepted? Does he belong? Is he good enough? He doesn't come from the same place as his fellow students. He doesn't have the same training as his fellow students who have a foundation for ballet at a much earlier age. So he's always on that search for acceptance and belonging, and I'll let you decide, or when you see the film, if he finds it or not. I mean, ultimately, we have to find acceptance in ourselves, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think that is one thing I don't want to give away too much, but he does seem to do well. He makes friends, but he has other challenges, and we don't want to spoil the film. But do you feel like you see a real growth of him as a person over the time you were all filming?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. I remember at the very beginning, when we would do an interview with him, he could barely string two sentences together. And it's not because he didn't understand the language. It was shyness. It was awkwardness. It was trying to figure out who he was. By the end, he was waxing poetic and very philosophical and had a strong awareness of what he was going through in the world around him. I just really proud of him.
Yeah, I mean, one thing to me that the film really captures beautifully is sort of both the hope and challenges of this type of opportunity being presented to somebody. You know, the pain of leaving his family, his relationship with his brother is very moving. You know, the challenge of being an immigrant far from home, but then the promise of this door opening and the changes he's undergoing. I mean, did you really want to sort of invoke that duality of this experience?
Yeah, all of it. I mean, even in terms of location, you know, this is a film that was filmed on two different continents. And we really tried, at least visually, to treat his neighborhood, his community in Lagos, Nigeria, as a character, and the community at Elmhurst Ballet School in Birmingham, England, as a community, and mirror the emotions he's going through. Yeah, it's also bittersweet. He's never left Nigeria. He's never been on a plane at the beginning of this film, and he has this amazing opportunity. But at the same time, family's really important. You see the happiness and the beauty and the love in that family, and he has to leave that. You know, watching him pack up and say goodbye to his family, and his family saying goodbye to him, his mother being his biggest cheerleader, isn't going to be there for him to catch him and hold him when he's in England. And so maybe bittersweet's the right word. I'm not sure, but you know, there are pros and cons and emotions that are up and down for him because of it. You know, something gained, something lost. Mom has to let the little bird fly out of the nest and see him grow and see if he can. And I think he delivers. I think he's amazing and inspiring, you know, but there's also a lot of pressure on him, right? There's pressure from on himself, pressure from his family in a way, pressure from the community that he's almost the family's hope in a way, you know, yeah. He the family's way. I don't want to say out. Nigeria is beautiful. He might go back to Nigeria and start a ballet school. Mm. So there's a lot of pressure. And then there's challenges and obstacles that are thrown in his way that he has to face. It's like a storm, right? You know, he's in that scene. I think you played it when he's on the beach talking about expressing himself through ballet, his pain and his joy. And, you know, is he going to swim through those rough waters to get to the other side? It's not easy, but those challenges are what, you know, that sour is what makes the sweetness even sweeter.
Absolutely. Of course, we do not know the end of Anthony Amadou's story yet. He's still pretty young. But I wonder what you hope people take away from this documentary.
Well, you know, it almost seems like an impossible dream for him. You know, how does this kid from this small, unknown neighborhood make it to Birmingham, England, to one of the most prestigious ballet schools in the world? And a lot of people, I think, suppress their dreams. They think the dreams are too big. I can't do that. I don't have the means. And we hope it inspires not just kids, but people everywhere to go for something that you're passionate about, whatever that might be, and to not hold back, you know, express yourself. If Anthony can do it where he comes from and the pressures and challenges he goes through, I think we all can.
That was director Matt Ogans. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Madu is coming to Disney Plus March 29th. Coming up on Press Play, Jennifer Lopez and Justin Timberlake are out with new albums, but does anyone want to listen to them? The pitfalls and opportunities for aging pop stars. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos in for Madeline Brand. Pop music is notoriously a young person's game. It's hard to stay relevant for long run in an industry obsessed with the hot new thing, but that hasn't stopped many a pop star from trying. New albums this year from early 2000s icons Justin Timberlake and Jennifer Lopez have been met with mixed reviews. And with big budget tours to promote these albums, are fans even interested in the new material or merely tolerating it until their beloved artists shut up and play the hits? Jem Oswad covers music for Variety and wrote about this latest incarnation of the aging pop star phenomenon. Welcome to Press Play, Jem.
Well, thank you. And thank you for reading my article.
Well, we really enjoyed it, as much as I'm sure the people you're talking about do not like being called aging pop stars. I want to start with Justin Timberlake, whose new album, Everything I Thought It Was, came out on Friday. Let's play a snippet of the new album from the song Selfish.
So if I get jealous, I can't help it.
So this sounds like fairly classic JT sound to me. What did you think of that track and the album as a whole?
Well, I mean, I actually really, really like that song. I think that's a great pop song. It's got a really sophisticated melody, and he sang it just beautifully on Saturday Night Live. The rest of the album is fairly, I don't want to say generic, but expected Justin Timberlake music. You know, the last album he made, Man of the Woods, He tried to branch out. That didn't really work. So he went back to what he does well, work with Timbaland and lots of hit producers and people like that. So it's, you know, it's what you would expect from a Justin Timberlake album. The problem with the album is the lyrics. The lyrics are so shockingly bad, just like in such a sort of ham-fisted attempt at sexy lyrics that I think the Daily Telegraph in England called him Pop's embarrassing uncle. Which is really mean, but not at all off base.
Well, he is a married father now, so I guess.
Well, and exactly. And the analogy I made in the article is it's like it's musically, it's like he was trying to fit into an outfit that he fit into in his early 30s, and it looks okay, but it's just not really right. So that was a problem. The other problem was just the sort of the way that they did a rollout for it. It was just very, you know, it was very big. It was a very old school approach to it, a very early aughts approach of flooding the zone and like having a great big announcement every single day and really whacking people over the head with it. And that doesn't really fly anymore.
Yeah. Well, the other person we're calling out here is J-Lo. Her new album's entitled This Is Me Now, and she paired it with two films, speaking of potentially overwrought rollouts. But let's hear a bit of the single Rebound. Got me on a rebound, rebound, rebound. Catch me on a rebound, rebound, rebound. We go up and down, we get lost. All right. Well, tell us what the reaction has been to this new album.
Worse than the one to Timberlake's, I would say. You know, obviously with two films and an album and a tour, all of which are autobiographical. I mean, there's a fair amount of hubris that goes into that anyway. Just like, you know, that's just an awful lot to be about her reunion with Ben Affleck, which is the theme of all of it. But the music is really, really generic. I mean, the song that you just played, I hear so many songs like that every single week, and they don't really stand out from each other. And if the music's not great, and I actually, you know, J-Lo is arguably a bigger film star now than a music star. And
what
she's
I was
doing
say,
great
it's not
that.
Like she was ever like, I don't know, the most sort of celebrated artist in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah, I mean, she was always multi-platform, if you will, but it's like, you know, it's not like she was ever a world-class singer, right? Justin Timberlake is a great singer. Right. You know, and she's, you know, she's certainly
she's a great
made the
dancer.
Most of the gift she has, but sorry.
I said she's a great dancer, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to be that mean about it. Cause I will tell you one thing that really struck me is that I wrote one paragraph in that article about J-Lo, even though she was in the headline, her fans are still coming after me on Twitter. Right. You know, I mean, they're like sneaking into my comments on Instagram, which, you know, whatever, but I haven't heard from a single Justin Timberlake fan. Anyway,
right, well,
she
hopefully
has a
they
very
don't find me.
Dedicated fan base. Yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, it is important to note that there are pop stars that have released major hits decades into their careers. I want to play a little bit of a number one hit from an artist who was 52 when this came out. So this is 1998's Believe by Cher. I mean, what do you think this type of blockbuster success tells us about staying relevant as an aging pop star?
I may be oversimplifying here, but I will say that that song and a much more recent one, which is Kylie's hit Padam Padam, in all honesty, they're flukes. You know, I think people heard Believe, you know, when it came out, the record label said, you know, like, this actually could be a major hit. And they were right. It was a huge global hit, very late in Cher's career. The Kylie song, that was a bit more of a surprise, but it was very well targeted. You know, I mean, Kylie knows her audience. And I went to, you know, a listening session at, you know, quite frankly, a gay club in the West Village. And, you know, I mean, that was her audience, quite frankly, or most of it anyway. But, you know, you also had a very, you know, a very accessible hit that was, you know, that I'm not surprised was as big as it was now. How do they follow that? That's the tough part, because it's been 20 years since Kylie had a big single on that scale before then, and they're very, very rare. And usually you don't get hit singles, but you might get a sort of return to form kind of album, like, you know, Bob Dylan with Time Out of Mind and a couple of Neil Young albums and people like that. But those are very rare as well. You know, they'll be selling out massive tours for months and months and months and months, and the record's relatively a flop.
Well, I know that one person this year seems to have gotten your memo. Madonna's new tour Celebration is essentially a musical journey through her career, right? I mean, is this what folks like her should be doing?
I mean, you don't want to say should. You don't want to tell artists what to do. And in no way was I trying to do that. You know, like, and even if I were, the fact that someone would actually listen is laughable in itself. But, you know, the thing is, it's like, I think she finally kind of capitulated to a degree, you know, because it had been an awful, I saw her in 2001 and she played maybe three classic songs and everything else was from whichever new album it was at the time. And she was still doing that. But, you know, they used the 40th anniversary of the beginning of the release of her first album as sort of the hook for this tour. It's Celebration, hits, yada, yada.
And, all right, you know, Jim, we got to leave it there. I'm sorry. Jim Oswald is an executive editor for Music of Variety. Thank you so much for joining us. Next time we'll have more time.
Okay, sorry to run at the mouth. Bye.
That'll do it for today's Press Play. We'll see you tomorrow.